Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Shankleberg, and Kirk Gray is just back from a pinball convention, which I didn't even know existed. So, and I know, Kirk, you've mentioned this before, that yes, there's gatherings of pinball enthusiasts that talk about the equipment, the gaming systems, the I don't know, how to make money from them, how to design them, what's the trends Everything. In the business, all that good stuff.
Everything. They have little side seminars. First of all, it's held in a hotel in Denver, and it's the second. This is the second annual one I've attended. It's usually this time of year, and they bring in 200 or more, mostly pinball machines, but some old video games such as Pac-Man and others.
And some of them
work. Pinball.
Some of them
work. They all work initially at the beginning of the show. let me just say that. But by the first day, it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went there Friday early and played a lot. And they're all machines are on free play. So they're getting, you know, played. You pay one fee and come into the ballroom, and you know you can pick any of these new machines or older machines, and they have all kinds of vintages. Obviously, for those who don't know, I was born in the 50s, so that, you know, I was long before there were video games, and I remember the first Pong. There was pinball, and those machines were for the most part back then electromechanical. They didn't have much logic circuit or anything. It was all relay logic.
But this is like a great big huge ball bearing, right? Rolling around with bumpers and springs and bells.
It has shock. You have solenoids. You have bells. High-powered systems, and the electromechanicals were pretty robust back then because they really didn't have any sensitive electronics. They were almost very high-powered coils and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Now those were in the show, and they are probably were the more robust ones. And so there's kind of three stages of pinball machine development. There was the electromechanicals, EM machines, as we call them, which are basically relays and solenoids and didn't have much sequence or logic to them or any kind of things
like
that.
That's similar to the car technology in the 50s too, right?
Right.
Right. We didn't have anti-lock brakes and electronic ignition systems. We had, you know, solenoids and valves and mechanical systems.
Right.
Yeah, very similar.
Yeah, the major pinball manufacturers, Gottlieb, Williams, Stern, were all manufacturing these different machines. The industry came up through the 80s and 90s and started to become more consolidated, fewer machines. But they also switched to solid-state type circuit boards, maybe TTL logic, still fairly robust, but the first logic boards and sequencing and things like that. And
They started using, instead of a rolling counter for your score, it was
LEDs.
LEDs, and they had to have electronics to control those and sensors to count those, things like that.
Right. Yeah. So those were application specific. I mean, the circuitry was built specifically using TTL logic or some other basic, you know, the prevalent kind of computing type systems.
It's also about the time we went from rotary dial phones to push button phones.
Right.
And, you know, again, very similar evolution in the fundamental technology.
Right.
And there was cost advantages to doing that instead of a great big solenoid and big relays and the high power and all the fans to keep it running.
Right.
You could make it faster and you could make it have more features, and, more bells and whistles, no pun intended, with a pinball machine.
Yeah, that's certainly true. More capability to do things with the lights on the play field. Now they have red, green, and blue LEDs that can be any color you want, and they just do some fantastic displays when you get to the higher levels of the game, what they can do control. And then there's been some new manufacturers like Highway Pinball and a company called Jersey Jack Pinball, which have done some really advanced work using LCD panels on the back plant or the back.
What so would be instead of just a couple of light bulbs, it's a whole display.
Now it's a whole LCD display, and there's like one called The Hobbit and Wizard of Oz, where they play parts of those movies as part of the sequence of the game when you've completed some level or something. But the problem is that, you know, the engineers, they're a very close group in Chicago and fairly tight, you know, in this industry, like the environmental chamber companies were all developed in Detroit and they stay around there in Michigan.
Well, all the private jet companies, airplane companies are in Wichita, right. Kansas, for some reason.
You get the specialists that stay in their town.
Right.
So Chicago is kind of the heart of pinball, and Stern, I think, is up there. But anyway, the next level of pinball machine now is coming out, is controlled by a PC. You basically have a motherboard, a PC motherboard at the base of the cabinet, of mm-hmm. the chassis, and it's doing very complex things. But by the same token, new mechanisms, failure mechanisms have come involved. For instance, I found out that they didn't realize one company that made PC, but you know, had a PC in the base and the circuitry, that the pinball itself, the little metal ball mm-hmm. running across the clear coat surface, would build up a huge static charge on it.
Oh, wow. So it hits a bumper, it blasts it with an electric charge. Yeah.
Exactly. And you'd end up shooting down killing with these pulses, killing your interface to the coil and to the circuit. And I found out later, you know, this was, I don't know how this was discovered. It seems like to me that they would realize if the same components that charge are
failing. Well, you know, they're pretty sneaky. Yeah, they're pretty sneaky. They can jump through components and sometimes damage them, sometimes not. Yeah, they're hard to diagnose sometimes.
Exactly. And so I can understand why that kind of problem would be very hard to find. You have to be able to see that very quick transient of an ESD pulse, mm-hmm. which could be sudden. So once they realized that was a problem, they put in a circuitry to short or, you know, cause what we would put, I forget the name of the device that would, a diode that would, you know.
They would shunt off the circuit. Yeah, it was a circuit protection device, and they would.
For ESD shock. So he corrected all that, and that solved half the, you know, but that would be a mysterious problem. And that would be something, again, I'll say, HALT would probably not find. That was an unusual electrostatic.
It sounds like free play for an afternoon is another way to find it.
Well, and I can go into details because I did talk with a design engineer, one who designs the machines, about how they test. And, mm-hmm. you know, they were looking at the life of a consumer. First of all, the minimum life that something had to have was what an individual would have in his house if he played the machine every day and the number of sequences it would go through. And
so this is like 5-10 years kind of on the order. But for a price point for those kinds of machines, I imagine it's, you know, they're probably expecting 20-year life out of these things. Now, if it goes into an arcade, right?
Right.
It's more often, it's played more often, but it's got to recover the value. Got to pay for itself.
Eventually. Exactly. $1, usually it's $1 a game now. Sometimes they're charging $1.25 for 3 balls. But anyway, that's a whole different world. But pinball machines are quite expensive compared to computers. They run from, for a new one, can be as low maybe as $6,000, but generally a little bit higher than that, mm-hmm, up mm-hmm. to $12,000 for a limited edition version, which
is. Well, you can imagine the licensing. You know, if they're doing Lord of the Rings movie clips. Oh, yeah. They got to pay for that too.
Yeah, they call them theme pinball machines that have a company or movie, Star Wars or Star mm-hmm. Trek or something like
Ooh,
that.
Oh, I didn't know they did that. I'll have to get into this.
Oh, yeah. You got to go check it out. Oh, yeah. Pinball, fortunately, pinball is coming back, and it's been pretty exciting to see what, with the new technologies, what you can do with computerized pinball. It makes it much more exciting and interactive. And mm-hmm. so they've really improved the technology, and I think you'll see a lot more pinball facilities opening up. And we, you know, I play in a pinball league, just like a bowling league, and we all get together. It's a lot of fun. So, but at the end of the show, there was 20% of those machines on the floor were turned off because of failures.
Right.
And, And pinball machines have all the environmental stresses built into them.
Well, they've got vibration and all the electromagnetic problems and all the forces. Banging and crashing this thing.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
If you did that to your laptop, you would not wonder why it failed, right?
Well, a lot of these machines have now, Stern, Harley Davidson, or almost all of them, you can put in these low frequency vibrators that shake the whole machine, you know.
Is a response when something happens?
It's just starting up. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You know, for some action, they'll shake the machine. I mean, this is a very large thing. And I asked the designer, would you run that as high level as you can and as long as you can? Until see what fails or falls out. You've got your own shaker built
in. Yeah,
that's great. And then the thermal cycling, I didn't get the feeling they did a lot there, but I feel like that would be excellent for the solenoids, clearances, tolerances, the coils, you know, and especially solder joints. Now, solder joints are a real problem in the reliability of pinball machines because inherently you've got all these resonant frequencies and these shakers and players bumping the machine, hitting the machine, shocking it is always going to induce fatigue life. And I've looked under there in some of these and they do, you know, the coil that you're soldering to is very heavy and a large thermal mass. And I know a lot of the people don't know how to solder that. You've got to get both surfaces, the wire and the connector up to the same that you're soldering to, basically up to the same temperature to get good wetting adhesion. And with the heavy coils, people using smaller soldering irons can't heat that up and they produce a cold solder joint. And of course that
shock and vibration will take that right apart.
Right. So a lot of these are, since these machines are 20, 30 years old, a lot of the self-repairs by home people, they don't know they're soldering, things like that.
Right.
But that's where, you know, obviously that'd be a second career for me. I love pinball.
But we're seeing the same evolution in phones, in aircraft, in vehicles, in just about anything you can think of. We were talking about washing machines in the last episode, and they've gone from like one button to turn it on and off, to geez, you need a master's degree in computer logic to turn.
You know, Fred, I bet you more than half of the customers, just like, you know, you've got very complex capabilities in Windows software. About half the customers never use any of those features. It's like me and I imagine you too. I don't know who that churns or dial the colors or whites or
Diane, my wife does. She reads the label. You know what would be a cool idea? We'll throw this out there and see if it then makes us buy a new washing machine. Is if it would scan the laundrying instructions of the clothing item, just scans it real quick, right? And says, yep, this goes in this load, or no, this doesn't go in this setting. You know?
You have to just hold it up to the camera and look at it. You know,
hold it up real quick, or just make it a little RFID tag that's sewn into the fabric, right?
Hey, there,
and just,
Fred,
you know?
Now, you just gave away a patentable idea that you just, you know, might make millions for Maytag or something, and you just
gave it away. Yeah, I'm that kind of guy, you know, but it's also to save me. I need one that can tell you what settings this machine should be on and if there's any crayons in the kids' pockets. I've watched a load with crayons. That's not a good idea. Not a good idea.
And Mick, just as a side, I did wash my Bluetooth earbuds set. And
come out bright and shiny?
And I, of course, plugged it in after I found it in the dryer and said, oh, it's gone. But I said, maybe I can save it. And I think I have by putting it into a bag of instant rice, you know,
to dry out the inside.
What do you call it? Desiccant.
Yeah, desiccant. And
it may have revived it. So I have to say, that is a very robust Bluetooth headset to go through a washing machine cycle and a dryer cycle and still come out working. shows that I'm happy.
Well, you should do it 20 times to see how much life it takes out of it.
Yeah. Do a proof of screen? Yeah, that's right. I don't think so. No.
You think so?
No. Okay. I you know, that's the way it goes. And I'm happy, although I would blame myself for leaving that in the pocket and washing it.
I was going to go back to this, the idea of you were talking about the evolution of the pinball machines. And one of the things you kept talking about was the new failure mechanisms they're bringing out. As they bring in more and more technology, they bring in different skills and stuff. Electrostatic, the roller ball for a big mechanical system, it could throw sparks off there. And the more sparks it did, and especially if they were visible, they would just look cool, right? But then you put a bunch of sensitive electronics under it, and it's like, now it's not cool anymore. That's bad, right? No. And if you make the system lighter, it's easier to ship. It costs less to do. You get rid of the big solenoids. You put in lighter electronics. It's all good things, right? Except now when the player hits the machine or bumps it hard, that force goes someplace. When it was a big, heavy machine, that got damped out real quick. Whereas these machines then go usually to the worst possible place, right? The motion gets transferred to a bad place and breaks connections or electronics or, you know, all those things.
Well, yeah, the box will resonate at its own natural resonance. When it gets hit with a pulse, it'll respond to everything. Right.
And the lighter it is and the more complex structures are inside of it, the more likely that pulse will hit a resonance and really cause a problem.
Right.
Whereas a big old heavy trunk, right? A big old cast iron bog, you'd have to hit it really, really hard to get it ringing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. At lower frequencies and things like that. Yeah. The resonances, pinball machines inherently have these fatigue inducing mechanisms that are built into it, and you will eventually wear it out somewhere, the coil or the you know, those are mechanical systems that'll wear out.
Well, so do cars, so do all
so
kinds
do cars,
of
cars, right, you know, right. The mechanical systems are the ones that fail more over time, and they do have a limited life relative to solid state electronic systems.
The other part though here, Kirk, is that if you just have more solder joints, right?
Yes.
You have more opportunities for solder joints to fail, to have cold solder joints or to be damaged or fatigue. If you just have, what we're doing with cars, right? We mentioned earlier that the automobiles are progressing, and my car's got more cost in electronics than it does in structure.
Right. You know,
the nav system, the GPS, entertainment system, the GPSs, you know, all this stuff, the communications, it's as or more expensive than other parts of the vehicle. And if I lost all of those things, I'd be upset, but I could still get to work.
Right. Car would start.
Well, I don't know. If I lost the electrical system, probably not anymore.
No, if the engine module failed, you know, electronic engine module failed, you'd probably not be able to run.
Yeah. So it's and now we're moving into autonomous vehicles. I was in I think it was a BMW, and he started pulling out of a parking spot, and the backup camera, and just instead of being a camera on the rear bumper looking backwards like my car does, it looked like it was a camera suspended over the car about 30 feet in the air, and it showed all sides of the car. And it was a ring of cameras around the car that were then regenerated into an aerial view looking down on the car.
Wow.
It was it's like, whoa, do that again.
Yeah.
Let me see how that works. You know, I stick my arm out of the side of the car.
And see, you wave it.
And it shows it, you know, and I was like, now, how do they do that? There's not a camera up there, is there? You know, a little antenna shoots up out of the roof. I don't think so.
No, but that's...
That's another way it can fail. And if that fails, right, if you could become dependent on, like, my backup camera, you know, my car doesn't have great visibility. And so those backup cameras are really, really nice.
Yes.
But if the camera failed, it's much more risky for me to back up. The car is counting on that feature working for that ability to see where you're going. And
yeah,
I would have to pay for that to get fixed if it failed.
Right.
And so we're making things more and more complex. We're getting more and more feature sets, and we're getting, you know, more exciting gaming experience on a pinball. We're getting,
right,
you know, new and different features for communications, for entertainment, for safety and vehicles. And it just, in my point of view, from a reliability point of view, it's great because now there's just more and more ways things can fail.
There is. There is. But, I looking at the technology advances and what they've been able to do, I don't see – I haven't – it's my personal feeling that the reliability has not – is not increasing proportional to the technological innovation.
We're still very good. Getting better. But think of it as, when's the last time you changed a tire on a car? You know, when you and I were in high school, it was like you had to know how to do that.
Exactly. But I've never rarely had a flat.
Yeah. Nowadays, the tire technology is so much better.
And they give you warnings. I mean, you look on your dashboard and you can see the little symbol of a tire before, you know, it's low inflation before it's actually gone flat. So that's one thing wonderful about the technology is I don't have to wait for the car tire to actually go physically or be observable flat, that they have pressure sensors in each one of the valve stems that transmit or electronically give feedback to the car or tell you exactly that there's a pressure
problem. I've had that happen. Yeah.
Yeah. And several times that it identifies a tire failure before it fails.
Now that's interesting. You know,
yeah.
I was making the assumption that we haven't had as many failures as we used to. I remember in high school, and it was probably because I had an old car. My dad was buying me the cheapest tires he could find. It might've been part of it,
but it was
like every month or every 2 months, it felt like. It might not have been in that frequently.
Yeah.
Now I have a sensor that tells me it, and I just drive to the garage.
Exactly.
You know, and 10 minutes later, they plug the tire, or they put a new tire on, and I'm out of there. Mm-hmm. I can afford that, right? Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, I'd pull over and change it myself.
Right.
So that's probably slanting my memory. But I agree with you, is that there's way more possibilities, failure points in a car or a pinball machine than there used to be. The reliability of these systems is improved because of integration, because of better advances in the material sets and our processing sets and stuff like that.
And better testing, hopefully.
And hopefully, you know, understanding and getting rid of those failures as we go. Mm-hmm. So I think we're making progress, but what makes it more complex for what we do is that there's just so many different ways to fail. There's so many different kinds of materials, so many kinds of interconnects, so many kinds of phenomena, and that keeps it exciting. That's what I think.
It keeps it exciting and challenging to find the real cause of the problem because it is a very getting very complex, and that's why I'm, you know, advocate a system level comprehensive testing. In most cases, testing the subsections, subsystems is certainly advantageous, but it really comes in when you get the big system together and it's all playing together. That's when you see, you know, the real issues. So, and you just mentioned one thing I just want to mention that you mentioned about solder joints, the number of solder joints that you have. That would be a much more relevant metric than for 217 when it was created than the temperature. That would have been, there would have been a higher correlation to number of solder joints and failures than anything else.
You know, that's been one of the things that's advanced electronics is we've gone to more and more ASICs and more programmable chips and more, you know, we put 100,000 or a million transistors on one device we got rid of all of those discrete components. That was a huge advantage to electronics reliability. Right. But anyway, so you sounds like you had fun at the pinball
machine.
Did have a great time. Did you break any of those machines?
I have broken many machines, yes.
Okay.
I broke – I mostly
And not in halt testing. You were just playing
No, just playing them. Yeah, some of them just the sensors. It's very, you know, extremely complex systems, really, and so some of them. But it's mostly electromechanical that I see fail. You know, the solenoids and things like that. And
do these guys see you come in with the toolkit and you take these things apart? So I'm just trying to fix it.
No, I'm negotiating with some of my friends here that are setting up the new arcade to help them out, because I do want to learn, and I find it, you know, I love getting into these things. I just repaired a Keurig coffee maker and a lawnmower, a small engine repair. I've learned how to repair a Briggs & Stratton carburetor And that was an interesting story. We'll leave to another time. But, you know, trying to get somebody, a guy that had repaired these many times, I tried to get him at a lawnmower service local lawnmower service. I asked him, what is it that's failing? You know, what is it that you're replacing in the carburetor that's causing the problem? And he said, I just had to rebuild it, and it costs, and by the time you finish, it'll cost as much as the mower costs at $120 you can buy at Walmart. And I go like, well, okay, any components?
Well, let's save this for an art. One of the things I wanted to ask you, Kirk, is and we've talked about, you know, the stuff that's failed around the house a few times. You haven't written an article lately, a blog post. You should grab some of these photos and write up the stories and get it out there. So it's I'm going to do a plug for you for your next upcoming article that you haven't written yet and get it up there. You know, just tell those stories in that way. And
that's right.
You can find a bunch of your older articles, or not older articles, just still relevant, good stuff. The drain in the bathtub curve, I think, was one of your most popular ones over on the NoMTBF site. Is that also on the Ascendo site? I don't remember.
I don't know. You're in control of all that.
Yeah, it probably is. I think we moved all your stuff over there.
We'll find a link and put it in the bottom of the notes.
Yeah. But go over and check out Kirk's articles. He's got a series of different ways of looking at, not different ways of looking at, good ways of looking at reliability, I should say.
Thank you.
And an entertaining way of presenting it. So if you like the podcast that we do and like these stories, go check out on Ascendo Reliability. It's Kirk, your series of articles is titled Accelerated Reliability, which I believe is also your company name.
Accelerated Reliability Solutions. I provide solutions. Solutions.
You don't just break things. I just break things. Yeah.
I provide a solution to your reliability problems. So
there you go.
But we have, I think this is our 18th or 19th or 20th podcast together. I'm not sure. We're getting up there. It's a lot of hours of us talking.
I think we got more than that. I think this is going to be episode 236, I think.
Oh, as far as total podcasts.
Total of them, yeah. But we've spread it out with a number of folks. That's cool. Yeah,
and they're all great. They all have a different great perspective on the elephant, you know?
Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, so as a reader, you know, one of the things we haven't been asking much recently, and I thought about it last episode, and I'll do it one more time quick, is if you like the show, right, and you think it's worth listening to, and, you know, please share it, you know, go share it on your network of LinkedIn or Facebook or wherever. Tell your friends and colleagues about it. If you're teaching a class, we'd love the shout out. Or if you're at a making a presentation someplace, if you recommend it to other folks, we certainly appreciate it. A great way to do that is to leave a rating and review. You know, go up to iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or what your favorite player, and there's usually a way to leave a review on that, and that primarily helps other people that would enjoy the show to find it, and they see those reviews, and it gives us a bit of an endorsement. So we certainly appreciate that, and it helps us to keep the show going. So we really like that. So with that, Kirk, let's wrap it up for today, and I'll let you get back to your pinball, either playing or fixing, one or the other.
Okay. Well, it's always great talking to you, Fred, and I think that we have a great agreement about so many things that need to be changed in reliability and cutting a new path sometimes to improving the efficiency of our reliability testing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So have a good afternoon, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Kirk. Talk to you later. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.